Every day we make choices, such as paper or plastic, right turn or left turn. Is that a second helping of mashed potatoes I should get? Do I speed to get to work and be on time? It's just a little lie. It can't matter that much. Do I work this one Sabbath for just a short time and kind of get ahead? Do I tell this person what I think of them, or should I just let it go? Do I help this person who needs help, or do I just keep on going? Some of the choices that we make during the day are minor, and some of them are major. Some surveys I looked at state that we make 612 decisions a day. That's, for the math people, 223,380 in a given year. It equates to 1 million to 2 million in an average lifetime. There's even a term for choosing the way we choose. It's called the analytical hierarchy process, or AHP. It tells us there's often conflict in the choices that we make. We don't know which choice to make. It's difficult, as we all know. We sometimes are stymied. Is this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? Should I even make a choice? Sometimes the conflict is easily resolved and we can do it without thinking. But sometimes making the right choice involves a tortuous and agonizing decision, one that even after we've chosen, we're not sure it was the right choice. When we make decisions and hard choices, what does our brain, through experience, our heart and our feelings, and our inner self really tell us? Because all three are often used. Within the New Testament, there is a section of Paul's writings where he openly muses, thinks about, very openly, as to his feelings, why he does the things he does, and the process that he's gone through. And so I've titled this, for those of you who love a title, I always get asked what the title is. This one's entitled, The Wretched Man's Choice. Turn with me, if you would, to Romans chapter 7. We are going to take a slight page. You'll see some similarities to a message Mr. Helge did give, where the theme is somewhat the same, but we're going to take it in a slightly different direction because it's a completely different set of words that Paul uses, and for good reason. And there's a lot of background as we get to the core of the apple here that we're going to have to wade through because he chooses his words very, very carefully. What you need to remember, there is no chapter breaks in the original. There is no verse breaks. It's all one continuous set of words. We have them in verses, thankfully, so that we can look at them a little more precisely, so we can parse them. So when I say chapter 7, verse 1, you know where I'm going. If I say chapter 15, verse 3, you know where I'm going. So in chapter 7, in verse 1, remember there's a continuous thought. And Paul here brings up a rather interesting argument. As I say, it's similar to a message somewhat a few Sabbaths ago, but it's different, very different, because this is highly personal. And he reveals a part of himself where he doesn't in a lot of other books that he writes, Paul does. And so there are some preliminary thoughts in these first few verses, and you'll understand the analogy he's using. He says, verse 7, "Or do you know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband, as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man." Now, it's an analogy, and the subject is really not about marriage. But the interesting point is, because Paul uses a number of twists and turns to get to his point. And these preliminary thoughts that he uses for Paul's time were very easily understood. As you probably know, in that day, in that age, especially in Jewish law, the husband ruled the family. And nothing happened unless The husband said so. He doesn't exclude divorce here, but he doesn't bring it up. And so the woman was really bound to the husband for as long as he lived. As he lived. And if he died, she was free to marry someone else. But she couldn't be married to two people at the same time. The word law in this chapter 7 is nomos throughout. And it typically means the Mosaic law. So marriage was carried through until someone dies, and he's taking the woman's perspective. The women were bound no matter what. So until the husband died, she was married. And so keep that in mind. The point is very simple. So death breaks the connection by law. If she remarries, however, remember that she is still under the law of marriage. She's now bound to someone else. He moves on in verse 4. He says in verse 4, therefore, because of what was said in the first three verses, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ, that you may be married to another, to him was raised from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. Now, Paul uses the repetition of verses. Sometimes even the New King James, which most of us have, will substitute a word where there's no reason to do so. And I'm going to try, and if you want to study this further, you can. But you'll notice the repetition here of the word bear fruit to God. So let's read it again. I want you to focus on this, the phrase into 4b we would call it, bear fruit to God. That you may be married to another, to him who was raised, Christ, from the dead, that we should bear fruit to God. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused or stirred by the law, very interesting phrase, were at work in our members to bear fruit to death. One, contrasting bearing fruit to God and bearing fruit to death. And so we see these two compared. He says, but now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. It's interesting, and I'm going to probably reference this a couple of times, the headers in my Bible, and yours may be different, are almost biased. Mine says at the top of chapter 7, freed from the law. Freed from the law. So we are freed. Antinomos, no law. But that's not what this says. Because it says we are married to another. What's interesting here is he uses the phrase about when we were in the flesh. Now, Paul was a human being just like you and I. We are literally in the flesh. You stick a pin in our skin, we're going to bleed. I'll guarantee you, the guy who wrote this, the Apostle Paul, if you stuck a pin in his flesh, he would bleed. So he uses the word in the flesh metaphorically. It can't be taken literally. And this will become important later on. And he says, we are now joined with someone who has been raised from the dead, Jesus Christ, that we should bear fruit to God. For when we were in the flesh, our passions, our sinful passions, were aroused by the law, and it produced fruit to death. Notice what produced the fruit. The sinful passions aroused the law. And he brings up a very interesting point. He then says, we are released from the law. But notice what has died here. Notice what has died. Christ has died, verse 4, and we have died, verse 4. But the law has not died. Just as in the marriage of the woman to the two different men, she was still bound by the law of marriage. There was still a law in effect. It had just changed who she was married to. So therefore, we still serve, but we serve differently. We produce fruit to God differently. Who are we serving? We are indeed serving God. Verse 4b, but now we serve him in spirit. Note this contrast in the end of verse 4 with the end of verse 5. The end of verse 4 says, the Spirit bears fruit to God, this life. The law in the flesh yielded fruit to death. Now at this juncture, one would get the impression law is a bad thing. The law produced this sin. Therefore, if we remove it, that would be a positive thing. And one would raise that question. Paul, in fact, raises the question. Verse 7. What shall we say then? After the first six verses. Is the law sin? Absolutely not. On the contrary, to the opposite, I would not have known sin except through the law or by the law. For what I would have not known, covetousness, unless the law had said, you shall not covet. So does the law produce sin? No. Is the law sin? No. He says, verse 8, but sin taking opportunity by the commandment, remember that phrase, produced in me all manner of evil desire. Why would he say this? Why would he even ask the question of, is the law sin? Well, it's a question that's asked today. The law is bad. The law is a negative thing. It produces sin. Therefore, logic dictates there must be some fault with the law. But that would be like saying, or similar to be saying, I was speeding because there are speed limit signs. If you take down the speed limit sign, I'm not speeding anymore. So let's remove all these signs, these no parking signs, or these limit signs over here, get rid of them. Therefore, we can't get a parking ticket. Right? Easy. But that misses the point. You wouldn't have caught me stealing this apple if there wasn't a law against stealing apples. So get rid of the law against stealing, and I won't be stealing. He answers it, no, the law is not sin. When we have laws on the books, it's for a completely different reason. It defines sin. It tells us what is wrong. When you were growing up in your home, just like in my home, mommy or daddy were the law. I reflect on it often. Becky on our refrigerator had one simple little bumper sticker. It was so profound. I'm the mommy. That's why. That was the reason. That was the reason she gave. I'm daddy. That's why. That's why that law is in existence. Because sometimes it doesn't make any sense to the kids. It makes no sense. But the law is there for a reason. It's because bad things happen. And the law, when it's violated, that is what is known as sin. We know very easily that 1 John 3:4 tells us that sin is the violation or the transgression of the law. And Paul says the same thing here. I would not, in verse 7, I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. Then he offers this very interesting contrast. And he almost seems like he is giving sin, we say it in poetry, personification. He almost starts to give sin arms and legs. It becomes something. It becomes something alive. Listen to the words that he uses here. But sin, taking its opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. Apart from the law, away from the law, sin's dead. So with the law, sin is therefore alive. Verse 9, I was alive once without law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died because I violated the law. I was speeding, I broke the law. I stole, I broke the law. I deserve punishment. But he gives almost this animation, as it were, to sin. Sin says, I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, here's that phrase again, taking opportunity. You may see the word occasion. It is the word opportunity. For sin, taking the opportunity again by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. This thing is alive. This thing can do all of these things. It's a living thing. It causes wrongdoing. It deceives. It kills. Law was meant for life, but because of sin, it caused death. It caused death. The problem with all these laws are not the laws. Laws are created. Laws are created because bad things happen. Is that not true? Are there too many laws? Humanly speaking, in this country, the tax code alone, you know, this last month we filed our income tax, and we always hear the same diatribe. The tax code needs to be simplified. Do you know that we increase the tax code by 10 to 15% in volume every year? So some laws can become overburdensome. But in this case, we're not talking about man's laws. We're talking the inferences to God's laws, which are not burdensome. In fact, the law is not the problem. Speeding on the freeway, the speed limit's not the problem. The law is not the problem. The problem is us. We're the problem. The law doesn't need to change. We do. Removing the law won't make things better. It'll make things worse because now there is no agreed upon standard. So the law doesn't need to change. We need to change. The law doesn't die. But as Paul says, we must. We must die. And therefore, he says in verse 12, he says, verse 12, therefore, the law is holy and the commandment holy, just, and good. That's an important statement. In the world in which we live, there are standards. And we would agree that in America, we believe that we would have some of the better standards. Probably not the best standards, but on a relative basis, the United States and many other countries of the Judeo-Christian ethic have some of the better standards. Because we are indeed, we do base it on the book that's in your lap right now. At least we like to think so. And so, in many ways, sin is exposed by the law. Today, sin creates law. As we pass new and stricter laws from a human standpoint, we find people breaking more and more the old, broader laws. They need to be tightened up and tightened up again. And that's why man's laws are never, ever perfect. People find, what do we call them? Loopholes. Loopholes are technically violations. And so they close up the loophole with another law. And that is what man does. He goes on to say, verse 13, has then what is good, the law, become death to me? He repeats this phrase again. Certainly not. Has then what is good, the law, become death to me? Is the law death? Was the law sin? No. The law was not sin. The law is not death. Absolutely not. But sin, that it might appear, sin, in other words, to appear what it is, was producing death in me through what is good, the law, so that sin through the commandment might become exceedingly sinful. Can you see this poetry that he's using? He's trying to build this tremendous contrast. The law's not the problem. Sin's not even the problem. It's we who produce the sin. We are the sin producers. In fact, we could rephrase this. If it wasn't for all these sinning people, God's law would produce the life as he intended. Right? If it wasn't for all of us, there wouldn't be a problem. But there is a problem. And so today we find that all these sinning people make something that was created for good, it creates death. He then moves into verse 14, which is the crux and the heart of his argument. He says, verse 14, he says, for we know that the law is spiritual, but I'm not. We are not. I am carnal, sold under sin. For what I am doing, I do not understand. For what I will to do, that I do not practice. In other words, for that what I want to do, I don't do it. But the things I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. How many of us are in this position? We know the right thing to do. We just don't do it. We want to do the right thing. It just doesn't happen. So the good things that we want to do and know to do, we don't do. And the things we know are wrong, the things we know down deep inside are wrong, we do them anyway. Isn't that the fact? It is in my experience. The things that we want to do, we have trouble doing. The things that we know that are wrong, we seem to do so easily. This is the crux. One of the issues, this section, chapter 7, verse 14 through 25 to the end of the chapter, is one of the most intensely analyzed sections in all of Paul's writing. There are volumes on just these verses. And I tried to scan as many as I could, and I'll give you the boiled down version. Here are the questions as we read these verses. The commentators want to know, who was Paul speaking about? Who was he speaking of? There are three concepts or ideas. Was Paul talking about an unconverted person? Unconverted. Was he talking about this is the way an unconverted person would feel? Number two, was he talking about a converted person? Someone who had been converted to the Christian way of life, to the godly way of life. And number three, he really wasn't speaking about either. This is merely prose. They call it the dialectic. It's just rhetoric. He's just speaking, as in poetry. So number one, was this a converted person, unconverted person? Number two, a converted person? Number three, neither. It's just open rhetoric. Let's read it. When we read it, do you indeed agree with this conflict? If you're in the Bible study earlier, I didn't change my notes to fit the end of the Bible study, but indeed it moved right from the end of the Bible study, the last 10, 15 minutes that I heard, into this idea. If indeed he's talking about converted people, it's a little bit troubling, isn't it? We're not supposed to have these conflicts. We're not supposed to have these problems. We have God's Spirit. This should be easy, not difficult. Let's read it again with this understanding. For what I am doing, I don't understand. For what I will to do, I don't do it. I don't practice it. But the things I hate, those are the things I do. By the way, let's remind ourselves who's writing this. This isn't some guy off the street or some theologian up in the Midwest or over in Europe. This is the Apostle Paul, the bastion of 13 different letters in our New Testament, the most prolific writer in the Bible. That's who's writing this. He's very personal, very open. If indeed he's speaking of himself and he is a converted person, we know Paul was. Here's the question. Down deep inside, do you identify with what he's saying? I do. I do. I wish all the choices and all the decisions that I make were so easy. Hate to admit it, I'm with Paul. They're not easy. They're very difficult. They're very hard to make decisions many times. Sometimes they're very, very clear. Sometimes they're not so clear. Sometimes the facts presented make it very, very simple to make the decision. And sometimes a very similar type of issue is so knotty and thorny and complex. It's just the way it is. And so, when we read it, can you identify with it? It says the law is spiritual, verse 14. But he says in the first person, I, Paul, am flesh. I'm carnal. I was sold under sin. He identifies, therefore, with everyone in this room. We are all flesh. But he said earlier, when we were flesh. Now he's saying, indeed I am. I am flesh. He continues, if then I do, verse 16, I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it is good. But now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. It's almost as if he's saying, it's not my fault. It's really not my fault. It's this thing inside me. It's my flesh and the passions that I have, they cause me to do it. Verse 18, for I know that in me, that is, parenthetically, my flesh, this body I have, nothing good dwells. What an admission. Paul says, I'm no good inside. Fleshly speaking, this human body still acts fleshly from time to time, and I don't do good things. Nothing good dwells, for to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good, I haven't a clue. I don't know how to do it. He says, I don't find, verse 19, for the good that I will to do, I don't do it. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. That I practice. So what he's saying, let me put it another way. Is it possible for a converted individual to sin? Absolutely. Regularly? Absolutely. This is what Paul's saying. He's not talking about a one-off issue. He's talking about a continuous practice. And he's not proud of it. He's being very open. Now, if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. Fascinating. Fascinating, fascinating. I want to do good, I don't do it. I hate what I do. Matthew Henry, which is a very old commentary, but still a very, very good one, he had this to say. The more pure and holy the heart is, it will have the more quick feeling as to the sin that remains in it. Be more aware. The believer sees more of the beauty of holiness and the excellence of the law. His earnest desire to obey increase as he grows in grace. But the whole good on which his will is fully bent, he does not do. Sin is ever springing up in him. Through remaining corruption, he often does evil, though against the fixed determination of his will. We want to do it. Down deep inside, we want to do what is right. But it is very, very difficult sometimes, isn't it? It's very difficult, or it can be. So we understand that the heart of living in the flesh when we desire to do right. And because of that, people suffer. They suffer inside, individually. I don't remember the source, but recently someone said, it seems that our suffering, individually, seems our suffering is tailored to each of us individually. As different as the clothes are on our back. I think I mentioned that probably too often. But when you look out from up here on all of you, you are all so very, very different. You don't look alike. You don't dress alike. None of you have really this ladies anyway. Forbid they have the same hairdo, let alone the same dress, the same shoes. We are all so very different. And that comes back to me over and over and over again. I know Mr. Helge would tell you, as with the other elders and Mr. Weber, when we talk to so many of you throughout the year, each suffers with different issues. Each has different choices in life. Rarely do we say to ourselves, we've heard this before. We kind of have, but it's so very, very different with each individual. Nothing is the same. Everything's the same. Paul never tells us what his wrongdoing is. Did you notice? He's very vague. He doesn't say, I have trouble with these issues. He's talking generally. Paul never tells us what his wrongdoing is. He never tells us what his wrong choices were. But we can identify with what he's saying, I would like to think. I can. As different as we all are, we all have this common issue. The difficulties of individuals are so different. So how does this make us feel inside? Does it make us feel more hopeless? Should it not make us feel more joined? The more commonality, and possibly the more compassionate. When you realize that the people sitting next to you, that you think you know, go through struggles that you have no concept. They don't talk about them. They don't dwell on them. It resides with them and them alone. How many of us feel inside hopeless or more connected and more passionate? I had occasion over the last couple of weeks, and this issue in Romans 7 came up, and there was a group, I don't know if I joined the group later, when I joined this little the group of individuals, and I asked Mr. Rudes to write down some thoughts on what he felt about Romans 7. And he gave me quite a bit, so I had to pick out what I thought was applicable, and they were good, so I want to share those with you. He talks about sins in general. They don't have to be absolutely horrendous. They could include failure to control your anger, pride, overeating or drinking, or poor manners to the point of disrespect, hypocrisy, or sins of omission, such as not doing good when it's our power to do so. On the other hand, who are we, I know this is a good one, Helmet, who are we to judge what sin is horrendous or what is mild? It's not so easy to appreciate weaknesses that we ourselves do not have, especially when you've overcome something that someone else is struggling with, that they've not been able to make a good choice over. We can cluck our tongue and say, huh, that was easy for me. Not so easy for the other person. And maybe the reason is because it isn't quite the same. And so it's a good perspective. I want you to look at verses 17 and 20, because they have a structure to them, and he tries to distance himself, Paul does, from what he has done. Verse 17 says, "Now then it is no more that I that do it, but the sin that is in me." Verse 20, "Now if I do what I would not," he says again, "it's not really me that does it, but the sin that dwells in him." He's repulsed by it. This is a big admission. He has trouble identifying. We don't like to say when we've done wrong, we've made a mistake. That's one of the things that human beings hate to do, because it means we have to show that horrible, horrible trait called humility. As you heard in the first message by Mr. Velasquez, does sin dwell in us? Yes. It seems that we can't seem to get the days of unleavened bread. I'm with you. I'm quite ready to leave them. Even though we've piled pounds and pounds of sinful leaven in our homes, I guess we didn't learn anything. The days of unleavened bread prove there was one sinless life. We find that during the days of unleavened bread, it is impossible. It is an effort in futility to remove the bread and the leaven from your home. There's only one way to do it, as some people do. You know what they do, the days of unleavened bread? Some cultures, they move out. They move out and they live somewhere else for 7 days. Because the point is, it is impossible to remove the leaven from our lives. Then why try? Why cut the grass? This is going to grow again, right? Why cut your hair? It's just going to grow again. Why bother? It's because it teaches us. Every day of unleavened bread, I'm reminded, I can't do this. I will try, and I think it's incredibly important to try to do this, to take the leaven out of our lives, because it says to us that we need God's help, just as Paul has said here, because we cannot do it on our own. It is futile. It is a wonderful teaching week, or a week of teaching. Without God's assistance, we will never even be aware of the need. Without God's assistance, we make choices without wisdom. People all their lives try and make decisions on their own, and it shows. God says we need to call upon Him. Paul now moves into a different vein here, where he accelerates the concept of what the law is and what evil is and what sin is. He says, "I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do good." Another unbelievable admission. "I find then a law that evil is present with me. I am trying to do good." Verse 22, "For I delight in the law of God according to this inward man. But I see," verse 23, "another law in my members," meaning his flesh, "warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members." So there are two laws here. Verse 24, O wretched man that I am. This is this horrible conflict. He sees down deep inside in his mind, he wants to do good. He knows what the will of God is because he is trying to live by with God's Spirit. He knows it down deep inside, but there is a war going on in his members. And such is the battle in an earthly life. You cannot escape it, but there is a way out. It has more positive than negative. It will end in success. The inside man literally means just exactly that. Inside the man. It's used by Greek writers in the idea of mind versus body. The mind was ethereal, the body was fleshly, and you can see. So he uses this concept of the conscience, the subconscious, the thing that after we say your very mind, the thing that after the body is withering away. And we've seen this so many times in hospitals where people become very, very ill, very, very sick. Their bodies are basically not functioning. But what keeps working? Their mind. They're just as lucid and just as clear, but the physical body, the members, as Paul calls them, they're basically non-operative. But deep down inside, the mind still works. It's still functioning to some degree. And this subconscious or conscience, this mind, is what Paul talks about here. And this is what he identifies, he says, with the law of God. He says, verse 22, I delight or I rejoice in the law of God according to the inward man. But there's this other law, two laws, God's law and the law of sin and death. Law of sin and death is what produces all the evil that we see in the world. And Paul understands this. And so the law of my members versus the law of my mind. A quote, going to get you again, Helmut, wherever you are. He said, what separates Paul's practice of sin, we understand the human mind to have at least two parts. So we discussed the rational intellect and the passionate emotion or instincts. In Paul's case, the sinful practice arose from his passions. He says so. This is flesh. Yet there is a sinful intent during the sin, but the mind is subdued or overcome temporarily. Something happens, obviously. But only after the passion has subsided will the mind be, he uses the word appalled. That was a good one, Helmut. After the passion has subsided, appalled, angry, a resolve to fight harder and to avoid the circumstance again. And then we are amazed that it happened. Isn't that true? After we've done something and we know we have done wrong, what should take over with someone who really delights after God's law? One thing and one thing only. Awareness of remorse. When we continue to feel bad about what we've done and we could not overcome it, as Paul says here, this is a critical point. The carnal fleshly mind, after it sins, doesn't care it's sinned. That mind will say, I'll do it again. It doesn't care that it doesn't care. It just doesn't care. And we have all met people like that. So these two laws and these two choices give us a battle. If you do not care when you have done wrong, flesh has won. If you don't care when you've done wrong, but if you do care, and we talk to people all the time, they say, I don't care anymore. And then they tell us how much they care about what they've done. That means they do care. That means they're not there yet. And so we see this over and over again. The spiritual mind does care. It does have remorse when it's done wrong. Therefore, Paul says in verse 24, O wretched man that I, Paul, am. How I'm afflicted. And each one of us can identify. This is not something to be ashamed of or negative about or feel depressed about. This is the human condition. There's no one in this room that has not gone through multiple conflicts, great and small, all their life. If you're young, the bad news is you'll have many more conflicts. The good news is there is a way to fight it and to win. Oh, wretched man that I am. Notice that he uses, who will deliver me from this body of death? Not what, but who? Who will deliver me from this body of death, this flesh? He says, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. That's who. He ends this section where he began. He ends the section with, we identify with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, which is tied up and rolled in the days of unleavened bread, the Passover, and the intervening wave sheaf offering in his resurrection. That is who we identify with. We live as he would. Who will save me? Jesus Christ through God will. And with my mind I serve God's law. He says, as he ends this verse, so then, with the mind I myself, my mind, serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin. He goes right back to his beginning. He says the obvious. We should not be depressed. We should not feel without hope. It should give us all the more hope. For Paul goes through this, we can identify with this. So this paragon of the New Testament went through this and still felt positive about it. Therefore, we can. Therefore, with one's mind alone, let's read it again. The mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin. Is it just your mind all by itself? You're just going to will this to happen? You're just going to intensely desire this to happen and it's going to happen? No. Verse 1 of chapter 8, remember there is no chapter break. There is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For the law of the Spirit of life in Christ Jesus has made me free from the law of sin and death. See how he's continued it again? And it also tells us the law, verse 2, of the Spirit of the life in Christ is identical to the law of God. It is God's law. It is Jesus Christ's law. Because he compares it to this law of sin and death in his members. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of flesh on account of sin. He condemns sin in the flesh, that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. We follow God's laws by using God's Spirit. That is how we make right choices. God's Spirit is something that gives us awareness. It gives us perspective of our surroundings and the world that we live in. We read things in the Bible differently. We see choices as what they truly are. And God gives us this wisdom. I was thinking of an analogy, and we know in the New Testament and in the Old Testament, they would use analogies for that time. Paul did in chapter 7. He talks about the marriage when a woman is married to one man. She's bound to him as long as he lives. He dies. She is now free now to marry someone else. He gives analogies. And I was thinking, what is a good analogy for the 21st century and God's Spirit? What is a good analogy? Well, a friend recently bought a newer car, and we went for a drive. It was plenty of power, and on the dash, I watched as they drove. On the dash from one end to the other was row upon row of lights and indicators. It was ablaze. Everything was happening. The steering wheel resembled a Formula One car with paddle shifters. All of a sudden, a beeping occurred. It was the proximity sensors built into the side mirrors. When a car on the right had come within range, got a little too close, warning the driver that something could happen. Later, as the driver backed up, more sensors alerted them to a car behind them to stop, slow down, look, be aware. And there were many, many more. There was a GPS in the dash and an alert as they were passing each Starbucks. I have it on mine. I thought everybody did. The owner's manual was 3 volumes. And we sat and looked at each other and said, cool. Very, very cool. You know what I'm talking about. And that's what God's Spirit does. It sensors. It gives us the ability to see things we didn't see, to be aware of things we weren't aware of, to understand things and people and circumstances around us. It aligns us, as it were, with God's laws for good fruit bearing and therefore good choices of righteous living. And we cannot exist without it. Proximity sensors in the car, you probably could live without it. But if you've ever had one that has it, They're pretty good. They're very interesting. They're very cool. So let's conclude. Since we have now left Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread, well, maybe John Velasquez and I haven't, and we filled our homes with all this sin called leaven and Trader Joe's bread, what did these days teach us, and what does this section that Paul in chapter 7 teach us? It teaches us that we cannot obey God simply in the flesh. It is impossible. We will sin. Our members of our flesh will cause futility. It is impossible. And yet he says, by identification with Christ's sacrifice, as those days pictured that we celebrated, our minds are united with God's Spirit, and therefore we have great hope. We have very great hope. We must understand and be prepared for that there will be a constant struggle of opposing forces. It's what teaches us and makes us stronger and gives us more experience, not less, and more understanding. We must understand that this will never change. This will never change. In fact, it has been said God has never used anyone that he has not seemingly hurt horribly. But we must always seek to use his Spirit to choose right choices, to stop and think and be aware. Because one day we ultimately will be changed. Because we do preach the hope of the resurrection, the general resurrection, and we are coming upon that as Pentecost draws near. One day we will all be changed. But it should also teach us three things. The idea of this struggle and this conflict. That life is not easy and that we must use God's Spirit. But it should teach us three other things. All of God's people struggle differently. A temptation for you may not be a temptation for someone else. A temptation or struggle that you overcome very easily may be very, very difficult for someone next to you or near you. And so be aware of that. Number two, it should therefore teach us great humility and forgiveness, that we understand one another a little bit better. And number three, and most of all, it reminds us to call daily on God, each and every day, sometimes multiple times during the day, as needed, for forgiveness, for strength, and for the guidance for each and every choice we make.